We have some more exciting news regarding our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. Rue Morgue magazine recently said this about the book. What separates Death by Umbrella from your run-of-the-mill glossary is the amount of heart and appreciation within its pages, recommended for gore hounds, list lovers, and trivia fiends. Well, we hope you're one of those and that you pick up the book. It's available at Amazon. Thanks a lot.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
I'm gonna kill that idiot!
I want a bologna and cheese sandwich for dinner, and I want it served in the garage.
Where have you been?
You got my order.
Your order? You've got your nerve! What do you think you're doing coming home drunk and asking for a peasant sandwich when I've slaved over that microwave all afternoon?
And come home drunk. I've been drunk all day.
We're downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 139, Microwave Massacre. Now with a title like that, you have a certain set of expectations. We're going to upturn those by quoting from Chekhov, the famous Russian playwright. The beginning of this movie features a microwave, and the Chekhov rule says that if you see a gun in Act 1, it has to be used by Act 3. You're basically setting something up. Here, first scene, before the credits roll, there's a head in a microwave, and the microwave is used later on. So, we are elevating the tone of this discussion about this schlocky sex romp horror film made in the 70s by referencing one of the great writers of all time. This is what this show brings you, and that you won't get elsewhere. What can you say about a movie called Microwave Massacre?
Well,
it's you can tell me.
Well, I was going to say, this movie was lensed in the 70s. It was actually made in 78. It didn't find distribution until 83, so a lot of people mistakenly think this is some sort of like 80s slasher spoof or what have you. It's not. It's a ribald 70s sexploitation with just a wee bit of horror. The horrific elements are there, but much more in a black comedy sort of way, almost like Eating Raoul. Mm-hmm. And I think that what happened was when it was picked up for distribution in 83, obviously it was in the height of the slasher boom, they figured, okay, let's now, like, you know, maybe dupe the public and make it seem like it's much more of a horror film than really what it really is. No, it's, like I said before, it's a black comedy, sex romp, that happens to have a little bit of horror in it. Now, you were talking about Chekhov, and you say you're the master of elevating. I'm the master of taking things into diverses and tangents.
Yeah.
And, you know, the microwave is an interesting thing. Of course, the microwave figures very prominently in this. Now, this microwave was fucking ginormous.
Yeah. As they were in the 70s when they came out. It was just, massive.
The microwave is ubiquitous in every kitchen. We don't even think about it. We have a microwave there. We can use it to pop popcorn. We can reheat leftovers. Nobody uses it to make any haute cuisine.
No.
But in the 80s, when the microwave started getting really, really popular,
this was what they were using it for, because at the time, you got to figure, there was, no basis for this thing. No one knew what to make of it. There are books about microwave cookery that came out at the time because it was like, you know, new frontiers of, in the cooking world.
I remember watching a television cooking show on the Food Network when it was very nascent, and they actually had cooking shows on the Food Network. As opposed to Guy Fieri,
with his scarfing hot dogs with his stupid blonde tips. Yeah, ridiculous.
If there's anybody I'd like to see murdered and hacked in a million bits, Guy Fieri.
And served in a chili, yeah.
But they had this show called Microwaves Are for Cooking Too. Oh. And it was how to make gourmet meals in the microwave. But then what I wanted to bring up was, I remember, and this was something that, I don't know, somebody said it and somebody else said it, and it made the rounds and it became fact. It was apocryphal, but it became fact. About standing 3 feet away from the microwave. How many times did you hear that from your parents?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, there is naturally wariness of anything that emits the kind of radiation and high heat. And it's no surprise that this would be used as an actual killing implement, as you saw in the remake of Last House on the Left, where the husband of the duo gets comeuppance on their tormentors, takes the guy, rams his head ridiculously into the microwave, sets it, and, well, burns it, essentially, from the inside. And but there is something, like, there is fodder for horror in something that could leak and potentially cause you harm, although it really doesn't anymore. It's such a safe device now.
I remember every time I'm popping some popcorn in the microwave, my mother's like, stay 3 feet away.
And but it's like the apocryphal thing with the cat, too. It's like you always hear about that sinister urban legend where the guy put his cat into the microwave and killed it, and someone may have done it for all we know, but there is danger associated with this silly device.
What danger?
When it came out, for sure. At the time, it's gone now. Like, you would never be able to get away with anything to do with those silly
microwaves. When I'm reheating last night's pizza in my microwave, I stand right in front of that thing for that minute, and that's one of the longest minutes in the world, waiting for that microwave to...
oh yeah, true. But even like with the you know, the materials that your food is in, it's like, oh, don't use like tin foil, you'll start a fire, or like toxins will emit from this, or like plastic, you don't put it in. There's still a little bit of it.
I stand in front of that thing, and I say to my wife, look at me, I'm right in front of the microwave. I'm living on the edge. And I gotta tell you something else.
You know, in this podcast, we always disclose stupid things, personal little vignettes and anecdotes. This is kind of embarrassing. I used a microwave to dry out some weed, which is sounds like the quintessential thing a stoner would do. I put it in a bowl, and I took it out, and the bowl shattered. This bowl just completely shattered. The weed went everywhere. I almost burned my hand. It was an incredibly ridiculous and stupid idea of the type you would only generate by having smoked weed. So, yeah, again, the microwaves.
But I've even put metal in the microwave to see what happens. It emits sparks. That's into that. All the stories surrounding the microwave. No, I guess, yeah, in the 80s, nobody really knew what to do with this thing.
Yeah.
But nobody can live without it now. Can you imagine living life without a microwave?
I actually do now, but for the most part, for most of my apartments, I did not. And boy, do I miss being able to cook a potato real quick or popcorn, especially as inveterate movie lovers like ourselves. Holy crap, do I miss popcorn.
Basically, that's what a microwave is it's the world's most expensive popcorn.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is. And, you know, I mean, I don't even reheat my pizza in the microwave. I use a toaster oven.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to get that crisp. But anyway, tell me about microwave.
But still, like, the movie is called Microwave Massacre. And there are pedants online who are going to bemoan the fact that there's no massacring happening per se with said device. Mm-hmm. But fuck that. It doesn't matter.
Some people have even complained the fact that they think the title would be a sentient microwave going out there and killing people.
Hey, don't give anyone any ideas for, films to greenlight. That would be awesome.
So a lot of people now are reviewing this movie, talking about this movie, and everyone's like, it's a bad movie. Damn right it's a bad movie. Mm. But this is a good bad movie. It's funny. You got to understand that this is not a horror film. This is a black comedy. This is a vehicle for a sort of like a hack comedian by the name of Jackie Vernon.
Yep.
Who was, I guess his greatest claim to fame was he was the voice of Frosty the Snowman in those Rankin Bass Christmas perennial favorites. Mm-hmm. And he would appear, I guess, on the Tonight Show doing a shtick. And he had a very sort of sad sack delivery. I thought he was a cross between two other very famous Jackies.
Jackie Mason and Jackie Gleason. Yeah, and yeah, a little bit of Rodney Dangerfield and Buddy Hackett. Like, he had these zingers that almost felt tailor made to have a wow 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 right after them. Yeah, it was a very very strange character to base a film around, and he is Donald, and he is a member of a construction team, and these guys are hilarious because we're introduced to them right out of the gate.
Well, first of all, we got to talk about the opening shot. This movie has one of the greatest opening shots in history, where the camera is focusing on a gratuitously bouncing set of bodacious tatas. This woman walking by a construction site, and in many construction sites, they have barricades erected so that to keep the public at bay, but there's a hole in it, and then she wants to look in and see what's going on. What are they erecting?
Well,
there was something erected happening because as she's looking through, this passerby goes by and pinches her butt. Her boobs go through the hole, pulling down her top, and her D cups are just spilling out.
Yeah, and you don't need to set off construction workers when it comes to sex. These guys are all over it.
And so you have our Donald, played by Jackie Vernon, and his two buddies, Rosie or Roosevelt, and Philip. And Phil goes, excuse me, I got to go to the restroom. I mean the restroom. And he's running over, and so is the other one. They're running like...
Yeah, like Usain Bolt to try and catch a glimpse of these tatas there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just what a way to begin. And these are the trio that we're going to become invested in throughout the film. And we're introduced to them, and they're having lunch. And Donald has this unorthodox repast for his lunch, which is a giant de-shelled, or whatever the word is, crab. It's just a full, giant crab stuffed between two panino buns. Yeah. And he's envious of his two compatriots because they have bologna and cheese, which is the standard lunch. And he's like, oh, my wife, she's always, you know, cooking me this crazy stuff. What I would give for a bologna and cheese sandwich. Mm-hmm. And
his wife, and we'll be introduced to her soon, her name is May, and she's a sort of this... kind of like a Balax wife, but she's very much into cuisine, as she calls it, and she's a connoisseur of she makes these so-called delicacies. They're just like unedible crap, like this spinach and whipped cream and shit. And, and then Donald doesn't know what to do because, I mean, the man wants a meal, and it's these two friends of his on the construction site. They're hilarious. I mean, there's this one scene where totally upending stereotypes.
Oh yeah, where the Italian guy Rosie Roosevelt is explaining to the African-American gentleman how to feel music with his ghetto blaster and tells him how to like live it and experience it, and the guy's like completely befuddled.
He's like, I don't know how to feel music, I don't know how to dance. And he's explained to him by the the extra from The Godfather, basically. So we have Donald again, Jackie Vernon, king of the shtick, and he comes home, and again he just wants a simple meal. And him and his wife, they're going at it over and over and over again. And, you know, she's talking about he hasn't been interested in her sexually. When was the last time we were intimate? He goes, you're a walking contraceptive, you know, and things like that.
Yeah, she's pretty insistent on trying to turn him into a gourmand. And she's cooking him, which this is gross, veal in a microwave. And then she makes him these romantic dinners, and he just won't have any part of it. He doesn't know what to do. His buddies are eating, again, the bologna and cheese. They're going to the food truck to get their foodstuffs for lunch, and he's just stuck with the same stuff over and over and over again. He's at his wit's end. What is he going to do?
Well, what he ends up doing is he kills his wife. They're having another argument, and something comes over him, some sort of compulsion, and he grabs a pepper grinder, and he bludgeons his wife to death with it. Next morning, he wakes up. He doesn't have any recollection of what he did. He looks inside the microwave and he sees parts of May. May is in the microwave,
yeah.
And he realizes he's killed his wife.
May! He's in the microwave? The way she would have wanted to go. But she hasn't gone yet. She's in there. Oh, brother.
And she's oh, you know, you see the hand, you see the arm, you see the leg, you see your severed head. Now, though, if anybody's listening right now thinking, oh man, it sounds really good and gory, it's not. Because these body parts are completely fake looking, dollar store, plastic, what have you, doesn't matter. He, after killing his wife, he goes to the construction site and he feels free. He goes to the food truck and he actually orders a burger.
Yeah.
And Rosie and Phil are like, look at this guy now. He's like, I feel better than I have in years, gentlemen. Yeah.
He admits he's separated from her and stuff. Exactly. And he's got a new lease on life.
And that night he goes home and he's got to do something about May, and he's in the work shed and he's trying to put pieces of her in the freezer.
Yeah, he's so overcome with hunger pangs that he just starts gnawing on the end of her arm, and then you see the camera pan down, and then you see her hand. It's again the fakest forearm ever, and he finds out that hey, this stuff is
well. He's eating it. He's really it, delicious. And he goes in another wonderful line. He goes, I may have underestimated May's taste. Yeah. He's enjoying the taste of his wife.
Yeah.
What are you doing, doggy? Get away! There's nothing there. Come on, shoot, shoot! Napoleon, she had to call him. I'm gonna kick him in his bone pot. Oh, well. Yeah, so long as I'm not. Guess it's better than nothing. Hey, that's pretty good stuff. Yeah, not bad. I may have underestimated May's taste. I never tasted anything so unique.
And the next day, this is a hilarious sight gag. We see him again on the site, and he's eating this enormous sandwich. The thing had to be about 5 feet long, and pretty much his wife's leg.
Yeah.
And as he's taking a bite, Philip and Rosie want to come by, and hey, give me a taste of it. Let me have a nibble.
They're overcome with how good it is.
How good this thing is.
Donald says to them, hey, I can just make you guys lunch for tomorrow. So, goes back to his home, has, by this point, his wife in various pieces in tinfoil throughout his house, and proceeds to
shish kebab
her in, a la Happy Birthday to Me, with his long kebab, with a hand, with an ankle, with a leg, with all these different pieces of her attached to this. Again, fake as fake can be. And we have this reference to 1962 repeatedly, where this was the last time he was intimate with her. He finds that cannibalism has spurred his interest, or reacquainted his libido.
It's like Viagra for him, and so he's at the bar, and there's a woman there, obviously late in the evening, and he takes her home, and her name is DDD. The joke being that her name was DD, but her mother had a stutter.
Yes. Yeah, they go through so many machinations because he can't quite perform yet. And I guess they do a bunch of role-playing, and then finally she just basically says, like, are we going to do this or not? And
then he
finally gives her a good stooping, and then subsequently smothers her.
He smothers her to death, and then he goes, I'm so hungry, I can eat a whore.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on.
Now
the two things have awakened in him, the taste for human flesh and...
Yeah,
the taste for sweet, sweet loving.
Yeah.
And they're not mutually interchangeable. He knows both. He goes to a doctor.
Carl Jung type guy, who's his psychoanalyst, who's on the couch and is bored to tears by the proceedings. He falls asleep during this disclosure that he can only get aroused through cannibalism, wakes up and misunderstands the story as being that he can only get aroused by eating out.
Well,
that's in cunnilingus. And he says, oh, there's nothing wrong with that. And
this becomes a gag. He goes, by the great Gatsby, go down on her.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, doctor. Now I feel so much better. This is the conceit of the film, is one bodacious woman after another coming back to his place.
Yeah.
Getting naked.
Getting killed.
And
getting eaten.
And
two entirely surreal moments. Mm-hmm. One of which, where he's walking down the street and sees a bluegrass band performing as a advertising gimmick for a local restaurant. And the woman who's dancing a jig in a chicken suit. And he approaches her and invites her back to his place for a meal and tells her that she needn't degrade herself to this extent is like the equivalent of wearing a sandwich board promoting like some store sale or something. And the other one being the very bizarre and surreal dreams that he had of lathering up a nude female torso with mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise.
This is very odd.
In many, I mean, this movie tonally is all over the map. It's hard to really pin it down. It's a sex comedy, which is, again, I mean, the humor, you gotta be into shtick. It's shtick humor. How would you describe shtick humor, Chris? I'm putting you on the spot now.
Oh, it's just the Buddy Hackett zingers. Mm-hmm. The Take My Wife, Please stuff. The Rodney Dangerfield stuff. And when we were prepping our discussion of this movie, you mentioned that the legendary Catskills comic was going to be in this role.
Not necessarily in this role, but that's what the producers envisioned. And they wanted to get him for the movie, but they couldn't, so they went with Jackie Vernon instead.
It was an ugly chick. I gave her a hickey. I got fur in my mouth. An ugly chick, I tell you. I used to memorize the routines of Rodney Dangerfield. He's a huge inspiration to me. I just love the guy. And although the timing of Jackie Vernon does not compare with the excellent Rodney Dangerfield and Back to School and all these amazing movies he was
Easy
in.
Money and
yeah, it just, but still, there's something, yeah, more of a lazy, more quiet delivery that he had, yeah. Again, a film that really only could have been made in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Swedish sex comedy, Italian, you know, period piece sex romp. It has these sensibilities. The shtick is the kind of thing that would have influenced, like, Lloyd Kaufman. It had that kind of element as well.
For sure. And there, again, and there's just these really funny sort of gags running through the movie. For example, he kills his wife. May is missing. The sister Evelyn comes by. Where's May? I want to see May. He happens to be holding May's severed head in his hands, and like, a la the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah.
How to find his back. He's very insistent upon seeing May. He says, okay, wait a second. She's sleeping. He goes to the bedroom, puts the head on the pillow. See, there's May. Take over. You have to go. And she's like, no, May's not looking too good right now. Because, of course, the head is, you know, rotting,
yeah,
decomposing.
Desiccated, yeah.
Desiccated. So he's like, I got to do something about this. He takes a bun, stuffs it into Evelyn's mouth to quiet her, to gag her, ties her up, puts her in the closet, and for the rest of the movie, he keeps opening up the closet, she's there looking around, and the bun is getting more moldy and slimy, and it's just weird. It's just...
Yeah, and that the Peppermill death I found hilarious, too, because I just thought of Saturday Night Live, which had a hilarious sketch of Dana Carvey playing an Italian waiter with a phallic, very phallic pepper grinder that he's waving in front of a customer, and, you know, asking how much pepper they would like on their salad, and he's like really like thrusting his hips and stuff, and the Peppermill death of May, it made me think that is the one that got away, and it would have included in
thing.
A inclusion in our book Death by Umbrella, the 100 weirdest horror movie weapons. Of course, no list book is fully complete. It's impossible to watch every movie there is. This would have made it as a bona fide inclusion into our Kitchen Nightmares chapter, because that was really cool.
This movie is funny. You just got to be in the right frame of mind for it. It's not a typical comedy. It's
yeah, to say the least, that is for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's not a typical comedy. It's not a typical horror film. It's neither fully one nor the other.
Most falls into the category of a sexploitation, although there's not really that much of really lascivious stuff in it, the exception of a few
boobs.
Oh, it's
more like a cutie.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense where, you know, you see a lot of naked flesh, but there's nothing too explicit, a lot of really corny jokes. And in a way, this is almost like it harkens back to those old movie cuties, like Kiss Me Quick and whatnot. And I really dug this movie.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And despite the many detractors and saying, oh, well, you know, it doesn't live up to its title, Jackie Vernon is not a charismatic guy. Well, you know what? He is charismatic. He's got the anti-charisma.
Yeah.
He's so non-charismatic, he becomes charismatic.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really like this movie. To me, it was a pleasant surprise. I sort of knew what I was getting into before I popped into my player. I knew it wasn't going to be like, you know, Sorority House Massacre or...
Yeah, I went into this flying blind, and I was anticipating, which is kind of a debit for me, is something, because I'm a completist when it comes to movies with massacre in the title, and I was really hoping for something more akin to a killer sentient mechanical device that would have laid waste to people. But by that token, I was still compelled and curious about this, and I did go with it. I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought, but I thought it was fun and ridiculous and engaging, and definitely unique. It almost has, even though the tones are different, it has almost a Sinful Dwarf quality to it. It's kind of sleazy in a way, but and yet kind of uplifting. I don't know.
Uplifting.
It's, in a way, it's so happy and joyous.
What it has, it's got heart.
Yeah.
You can really feel that there's heart too. You can really feel this was a labor of love. Everybody that was making this movie were making something that they felt passionate about. Again, the duo of Rosie and Philip were just uproarious, almost like Lenny and Squiggy almost, yeah. Perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah.
There was a lot, I wouldn't say uplifting, but joyous is definitely a good adjective. Also, another to this movie's credit, it's like 73 minutes long. It's not boring.
Yeah.
It's fun. It goes by, and it's entertaining. I liked it.
Oh, for sure. And then we'll segue into what we've learned, and by way of, again, the gags. This is vaudeville humor infused, and there's one point where a put-upon, disgusted May is just so fed up with her husband's recalcitrance and inability to try new things and become cultured. She takes the plate and just dumps it on his head. And, of course, he's got, like, the crossed eyes and the plate of food is on his head. And
but that was hilarious, too.
That was funny as hell.
But not only that, because she's talking about cuisine and this is a delicacy and so on and so forth. And, you know, saying, oh, you have no taste. And meanwhile, she's serving these so-called, wonderful creation of hers on paper plates.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And stuff that looks absolutely vile. Like, I was a big fan of veal growing up in an Italian household. Vitello, like, you know, veal chops and veal sandwiches. Oh, my God. I just love that. And the entire concept of, well, massacring, to use the word, a poor veal in a microwave. Oh, I just couldn't even imagine. All things, just, it would be awful. It would be awful to cook any meat in a microwave. You got a feel for the guy. And a terrific line about their little dog, Napoleon, and he gets fed up with the thing and says, listen, if you don't be quiet, I'm going to kick you in your bone apart. So this is the type of humor we're dealing with. Very groany, groan style, very vaudevillian and kind of cornball, but by the same token, strangely watchable. What else did we learn here? There's a great bartender.
Oh, that was
just a fantastic guy who just runs the local watering hole, and the construction workers go there after work. Mm-hmm. And he upends the trope of the bartender listening to the sad sack story of the client turning the tables and talking about this horrible story about his hemorrhoids and how it's shitty being a bartender is you got to stand all day and it's bad for his hemorrhoids.
They're going on and on. He goes, you know what? You see the license up there? That's a liquor license, not a shrink license.
Yeah. It's hilarious because, you know, bartenders are, that's what they're there to do, ostensibly. Some alcoholic plunks himself down in the bar stool, bends their ear like Sam Malone in Cheers, pours out their heart of all their trials and tribulations. That's got to be fucking annoying for a bartender. So he says, fuck it, I have hemorrhoids. I stand here all day listening to you guys. Hilarious. That was just great. The bartender was amazing. What did you learn?
Well, this is actually something I learned from watching a making of featurette on the Blu-ray. Not only did I learn that at one point the producers really wanted to get Rodney Dangerfield for the lead role for Donald, the house they filmed in, they had a very short window of time to film it because the former occupant was moving out and the new occupant was moving in. And if I tell you who the former occupant was, you would be quite surprised.
Whoa, who?
Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees.
Of that place.
That shitty house.
That shitty fucking dump.
So that goes to show you where Mickey Dolenz's career was in 1978.
Oh, wow. Oh, my.
When he was living in that garishly
not exactly the
shit shack, yeah.
Not the Hollywood Hills.
No, not at
Holy
all.
Holy crow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You look befuddled right now.
This is just, it's just a humble bungalow, right? Like, what? Wow. I mean, who am I to cast aspersions on where anybody lives, considering where I live? But, yeah, that is something. Like, hey, I guess
he took the last trip to Clarksville. And,
yeah. But they didn't earn songwriting royalties, right?
A lot of the songs were written by Neil Diamond and whatnot.
Yeah, so that's what you get. If they could only generate royalties from touring,
he wasn't like Michael Nesmith.
It was a fake,
band. Well, no, they weren't a fake. Well, yeah, okay. Some of them did play instruments. Some of them were actually talented. Michael Nesmith was. I believe Dolenz actually was talented, but most of his songs weren't written by them. They were written for them. They were a fabricated band. They had a TV series that was on for a couple of seasons. They made a very bizarre movie, a la A Hard Day's Night, called Head.
Oh, which is, yeah, full of, like, LSD and all this crazy stuff.
Really,
yeah,
bizarre movie.
we should podcast that.
Yeah, but yeah, another little interesting Monkeys fact, I mean, here is another diversion. As I said, he's no Michael Nesmith. Michael Nesmith, who was one of the only really, truly musically talented gift people of the Monkees, his mother invented liquid paper. So he's the heir to the liquid paper fortune.
Wow, well, that's something and to fall back on.
She invented it by accident. She was doing something on the stove, and all of a sudden she created this white goop, and it became liquid paper. So Michael Nesmith was rolling in the dough.
Hey, well, and it all comes back to the stove and the microwave. And it's all together. It all ties together.
There you go.
That is amazing.
So so I challenge you, when you go home tonight, Chris, put something in the microwave and stand right in front of that sucker. Don't worry about it, man. Yeah. It will not render you sterile, and you'll be just
fine. It will not cook my brain waves or like my cerebellum or anything. All right,
put a fork in it, man. Watch the fork fly. It's great fun. It's great fun. Star rating for Microwave Massacre.
Oh, good times. 3 out of 5. Pretty hilarious, weird stuff. Again, Sinful Dwarf, kind of like a weird pairing of killing with sex in a romp kind of way, but that was far darker, obviously. But I don't think I've seen anything quite like this. Mm-hmm. Like, we talked about the Nudie Cuties and Kiss Me Quick, and that did not have the cannibalism or the killing. It just had the lab and the bodacious babes. This is this a unique beast? Like, is this a genre? I don't know. This has to be a unique piece of work. This is similar to Eating Raoul, which we podcasted. So a cannibal-themed, zinger-filled yuck fest.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not like that at all. It's totally different. This is different.
It's
this
like
is
that, really, but it's not like that.
It's
a singular
tangentially.
Beast.
It is a singular
beast. And if you're in the right frame of mind, it's entertaining. And I, too, am going to give it 3 stars. It's by no means a 4-star classic. But it's nowhere near as bad as people are, you know, saying it is. It's fun. It's not a horrific massacre a la the Texas Chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an uproarious comedy a la Easy Money. But it's something in the middle. And it's, like as I said before, it's 73 minutes.
Yeah.
You've spent more time watching shittier things than this.
This is very true.
It's a good one. And for more,
check out www.reallyawfulmovies.com. And, of course, new episodes of our podcast every Friday. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.